Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you that the following podcast was produced for the Southern Labor Studies Association. You can visit the SLSA online at southernlaborstudies.org, and you can follow the SLSA on Twitter at SouthernLaborSA. I hope you enjoy the following interview.
Welcome to Working History, a production of the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org. I'm series host Beth English, and today I'm speaking with J. Blake Perkins, Associate Professor of History at Williams Baptist College. He is the author of Hillbilly Hellraisers, Federal Power and Populist Defiance in the Ozarks, published by the University of Illinois Press. Blake Perkins, welcome to Working History.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your book, Hillbilly Hellraisers, looks at the region commonly referred to as the Ozarks and quote-unquote populist politics there. You're a native of the Ozarks, so I thought to get us started, you could maybe tell us a little bit about the region, where it is, for those listeners who might not know what it's like, and how your personal experience of growing up on a farm in rural Arkansas influenced your insights and approach to the book.
Okay, yeah. Well, the Ozarks is a region in Middle America. It's an upland region, a mountainous region, although geographers describe it as an eroded plateau. Mm-hmm. But it has a lot of similarities with Appalachia.
Okay.
Back east. So, in fact, historical kinship of early settlement patterns, migration patterns, and things like that. But there are a lot of similarities with Appalachia. A better known region, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yes, I grew up on a fifth generation family farm. Lived in a very small community. The nearest small town had a population of fewer than 80 people.
Oh wow!
But went to a small public school district nearby. In fact, after my senior year, the school had such a small enrollment that it was required to consolidate with a neighboring school district. So it's a very small, partially populated area. But yeah, I grew up on a farm and have come back and live here now.
Mm-hmm.
Live in the same area where I grew up and teach at a small college nearby. You know, growing up, obviously, I was very interested in my grandparents' lives and the stories they would tell. And it was very apparent to me very early that things change in rural America, and you know, sometimes the image or myth, you know, kind of that rural societies are stagnant or stay the same, or kind of places of permanence,
mm-hmm.
just really didn't set. I mean, my family has deep roots in the region, but again, the small town. I mean, the stories they would tell about this small town that, you know, having a movie theater once upon a time and several different stores, and by the time I was a kid growing up, I mean, it was not really a ghost town, but practically
mm-hmm.
a ghost town. So anyway, it was very apparent to me that things do change. And I think that impression really influenced me early on, because one of the key themes of the book is that things change.
Right.
But yeah, and I started graduate school, you know, as we talk a little bit about politics, started graduate school in the fall of 2008. And so I was really interested in the very loud anti-Obama political culture that was really growing and has grown even more, I think, since then. So I began to wonder very early on there in my graduate studies if this, you know, has something to do with maybe sour relationships between rural people, rural regions like the Ozarks in history, mm-hmm. with the federal government, mm-hmm. in history. So my own background definitely influenced and shaped this book in many ways.
And so your approach in some ways is, this idea, really kind of a basic idea, but in a lot of ways a transformative one when you think of the way people think of rural areas, that things change. So this, in a lot of ways, then helps us or encourages us to rethink the stereotype of the Ozarks, right, of the moonshiners, of the assumptions about anti-government and don't tread on me culture there. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, that was sort of the impression I had going into this. Mm-hmm. As I began to look more closely at it, those assumptions just weren't holding up. This presumed kind of anti-government culture, supposedly rooted in, you know, the first settlers, white settlers who arrived to settle in the region, and especially the moonshiner image, and that was really entrenched in the region, mm-hmm. In the late 1800s, early 1900s. I mean, publications like the New York Times were covering the sensational moonshiners versus the feds, mm-hmm. kinds of stories in the region, and that really, I think, helped to, as I said, kind of entrench that image of these backwoods people that supposedly are lost in yesteryear and want to be left alone. Mm-hmm. They don't want anything to do with government. They just don't tread on me kind of ideas. But as I said, and this book shows, it's far more complex than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk in more specifics then about the book. To start off, could you give us sort of a framework to understand what the economy of the Ozarks was like in or by the early 20th century? What sorts of work were rural folks doing? How were they surviving in an economic sense, first of all?
Okay. Yeah, this is a very important time in the history of the region. This is a time when most rural Ozarkers were small family farmers. Mm-hmm. They, and the definition of that is a little bit vague. We need to, as rural historians, maybe do a little more work on that. I don't think some have tried to use acreage and things mm-hmm. like that to try to determine what is a small farmer, right. But none of those really seem to capture it, I don't think. But I think probably the big thing is that when we think about family farmers, they did most of the labor, most of the work themselves, mm-hmm. or as a family unit. Uh-huh. Maybe occasionally hiring some help, maybe during a very, very busy time in the harvest season, or maybe neighbors might help one another out. If one family got their crops in before the other one did, they might, so there was some work swapping, mm-hmm. I might say, mm-hmm. going on. But for the most part, the labor, the work, the production of the farm was being done by the family, not hired, wage labor, things like that.
Right.
So that's what the majority were landowners. They owned their farms. Again, these could range from 20 acres to a couple hundred acres, mm-hmm. or so. But mm-hmm. But they had that in common. But it's an important time because this is obviously the era of industrialization,
right.
And we see that impact of that in the region during this time. And so markets are becoming more and more important. Outside markets, that is, national, mm-hmm. and even international agricultural markets. Mm-hmm. Railroads are penetrating the region. We start to see early patterns that are going to become more and more apparent as we march on in through the 20th century of that a farmer is not just a farmer. I mean, there are larger farmers, more highly capitalized farmers. There is a rising, I guess what we call middle class or really elite class, mm-hmm. emerging, that kind of the middle men in this economy, they're doing quite well in this, and they want to see more of that, mm-hmm. that pattern continuing. There's more of a what would become more of an agribusiness kind of industrial model. Mm-hmm. And so it's becoming already at that point, as early as the 1870s, 1880s, some of the signs of that are appearing. And it becomes more and more difficult for these smaller farmers to really continue to, you know, make a living in this economy. And so thus some of the populist politics that we'll talk about later.
Yeah, we could actually maybe launch into that, but real quickly, what were these small farmers growing? Were they sort of the traditional kind of yeoman farmer where they're maybe growing corn or wheat as sort of a cash crop, and then the rest is, you know, sustenance for the household? Or, you know, what are they doing? And then as this transition is happening with the railroads penetrating and these sorts of things, do we see that transition that happens at a lot of places where the more market oriented the farms get, the less self-sustaining they are? Is that also happening here?
Yeah. I mean, that idea of a truly, purely subsistence farmer just really doesn't hold up all that well. I mean, there were only a handful of those, but most of these farmers are engaged in markets. And there are sub-regional variations of that, you know, in the eastern part of the Arkansas Ozarks. And by the way, I should say, even though Missouri Ozarks are as big or bigger part of the region, my book focuses on the Arkansas Ozarks. So in the eastern part of the Ozarks, which is actually where I'm from, I mean, these hill farmers were even growing cotton.
Okay.
So the cotton
okay.
economy had even, although you don't see that further west you go in northwest Arkansas, for instance, you don't see much cotton at all. They're growing things like wheat, grains, and things. And of course, all these farmers, corn, I guess, was pretty uniform in that most farmers grew corn. And then another thing I talk about, and I've got a whole chapter on it in the book, livestock farming.
Okay.
And specifically, I'm talking about cattle, but hogs as well. So, I mean, these are cash crops, and they're marketing these livestock and cotton, or even marketing corn. And that's one of the things that I get into in the chapter that I discuss moonshiners and the markets there. They're market oriented. They're hoping that these markets are going to help them sustain, you know, the family farm and able to live the American dream. That truly was the idea of the American dream, for them to be able to sustain and prosper as family farmers, as smallholders, as I refer to them.
Right. So let's talk a little bit then about, you know, the regions, as you talk about it, a populist ethic among the rural small landholders and family farmers. And you talk about this group as working class, which I found very interesting, because that's a term often associated with industrial rather than rural work and workers. So could you talk a little bit about how and why you see these farm folk as working class, number one, and then number two, would they have identified themselves as such, as part of a quote unquote working class, or would they have seen themselves differently?
Yeah. I'll answer the last part of your question there, I guess, first. I tend to view them as working class largely because I think they identified themselves as working class. So, this populist ethic that I talk about in the book, I mean, we see thousands of these small family farmers, especially in the 1880s, we begin to see it in the Ozarks, especially strong there, joining these farmers' unions, essentially. I mean, these organizations, one of the most prolific in northwestern Arkansas was called the Brothers of Freedom. It's a predecessor to the Farmers Alliance. Of course, the Farmers Alliance is kind of a predecessor of the what eventually became the third-party populist movement there in the 1890s. But this Brothers of Freedom, I mean, if you look at the they claimed somewhere between by the middle 1880s, they claimed between 30,000 and 40,000 people, and that was a significant slice of the population there. So it's a very large organization, and if you look at the language of this organization, others like it, I mean, they're talking about they're deeply concerned about the rise of economic inequality, the rise of a privileged elite moneyed class, and they're talking about how that money class is oppressing what they call the laboring masses. And so they identify themselves as laborers, as part of the laboring masses. And then we see this even after the so-called, you know, the third party movement had fizzled out, even with the Farmers Union in the early 1900s, the national organization, but it continued to be, I mean, this was the largest interest group in the state of Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And so there were lots of these farmers, and they're talking about the same things.
Mm-hmm.
Advocates of progressive regulations, progressive taxation, things like that. But yeah, they're definitely identifying themselves as working people. And back to the late 1800s, the Brothers of Freedom, that group merged with another similar group, and then eventually became the Farmers Alliance. But they actually worked together with the small Knights of Labor in Arkansas, mm-hmm. Especially in the 1888 gubernatorial election and some congressional races there. They forged they called themselves such, a working class coalition there, and came as close as ever to knocking off the Democratic establishment in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be a pretty nasty election. But anyway, again, they identified and worked with urban working class. They saw themselves as working people. And they saw their struggles as small farmers and the difficulties of trying to make a living as part of this broader struggle of the late 1800s, early 1900s, vast inequality that's growing here. And again, much like urban workers, they decided oftentimes to band together collectively to see if they couldn't get something done,
mm-hmm.
change.
Mm-hmm. Fast-forwarding just a bit, but not too much, with the New Deal, residents of the Ozarks, like millions across the nation, will begin to experience and feel the reach of the federal government in new ways. But before we talk about the New Deal, you do quite a lot of work kind of leading up to that to try to show how Ozarkers experienced and interacted with the government both on local and federal levels before the 1930s. And what I'm hoping you can do for us is sort of in broad brushstrokes, talk about this, you know, this interaction with government, number one. And then number two, you give a couple of sort of poignant examples of this. Number one, draft resistance and anti-militarism during World War I, and then also a tick eradication program by the USDA. So could you, first of all, talk about that, you know, broadly speaking, interactions with government, and I'm, you know, sort of using that term very loosely, and then give us those examples and talk a little bit about how those informed your analysis and led you to this conclusion that, you know, these weren't simply knee-jerk reactions of anti-government culture.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this populist ethic that we were talking about, I mean, it saw a crucial role for government.
Mm-hmm.
These populists believe that that government was really the power of the people.
Mm-hmm.
They said that.
Mm-hmm.
They equated government with the people, you know, and they believed that it needed to play a role in regulating and even redistributing the economy and so forth to ensure that ordinary working people still had a fair chance and things like that. So they did have this view that the government ought to be playing a role. At the same time, the programs that began to be implemented as the, you know, modern state developed and as the federal government began to be felt more and more in the early 1900s and so on, these were usually pretty raw experiences for many rural Ozarkers.
Mm-hmm.
These programs were often funneled through local elites,
mm-hmm.
and often these local elites had their own agendas, had their own visions for what the Ozarks should be, and wanted to use that power and those resources to achieve that instead of the kinds of reforms that working class people were wanting. And so, yeah, we see this over and over again. This is a pattern that I saw emerge as I looked at these various case studies,
mm-hmm.
from the standoff between moonshiners and the feds and so forth, to rural draft resistance during World War I, to some of these early USDA farm programs and so forth. These programs that are intended to be progressive, right, to help farmers and help rural communities, often help those who already hold more power.
Mm-hmm.
Those who already are doing fairly well by regional standards, they tend to help them, and oftentimes they hurt the poorer smallholders in the backcountry. For instance, the tick eradication program. This was a program developed to that were for the cattle for, cattle farmers by the USDA to eradicate. The idea was to eradicate tick fever, which is a biological disease that was problematic for the cattle industry and so forth. We see this pattern really there because the ones who were wanting that program and the ones who oversaw that and really implemented it on the ground and used even police force to carry it out were the wealthier farmers who were importing purebred livestock. And these purebred cattle were the ones that were vulnerable to the disease.
Okay.
Any of these small backcountry farmers, poor farmers, their cattle were these native or often called scrub breeds that had been in the region for generations, and they had developed over time kind of immunity to this disease. So it wasn't really didn't seem to be affecting them that much. But nevertheless, this program was sold as a program that will help all farmers.
Mm-hmm.
It'll raise all boats, in other words. And yet the tax burden for that ended up being, it was basically a flat tax enacted to help fund it. This did not go over well among smallholders, and they viewed it as something gotten up by and for rich and well-to-do farmers. Really opposed it from that angle throughout that. You asked about draft resistance during World War I. This is often a forgotten story in rural America. There's been more work done on that. Jeanette Keith's book, Rich Man's War, Poor Man's Fight, has shed a lot of important light on rural draft resistance in the South.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, this was not a popular war, and it was often opposed and later resisted the draft, especially resisted as these small farmers saw it as a scheme gotten up by wealthy interests to make more money, and then they were going to have to do the fighting.
Right.
So that was a common theme over and over again. Religion sometimes played a role in that as well. A lot of these smaller backcountry churches were deeply opposed to the war theologically, but also, again, the idea that this is an unfair, rich man's war, poor man's fight kind of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
As we, as they moved into the era of the New Deal, right? And you have this massive expansion of federal programs being introduced into the Ozarks, among, many other places. Do you still see the attitudes towards these programs being viewed through this lens of class conflict in some ways? Or, what was happening? Were the attitudes changing? Were they kind of carrying over? Or what was going on there?
Yeah. Well, there may have been some rural folks who, had just simply been burned too much by previous programs that they now saw no role for government. But I thought it was somewhat remarkable as I read into the sources, your letters to the editor and newspapers and so forth, letters to governors and during the early, the great early depression era, as the depression set in, just how much hope there was among these many of these rural people, a hope that government could step in and do something. Mm-hmm. And so I found by far, far more support for the New Deal than opposition. And in fact, in some of the the region as the state as a whole was largely Democratic, you know, part of the Solid South. But there were pockets. There were a couple of counties, especially Searcy and Newton counties, Northwest Arkansas, that going all the way back to the Civil War had been Republican strongholds. And even there, we see this interesting dynamic, people deciding to vote for FDR, you know, and other New Dealers. And see it again, letters to the editor, editorial positions in those local papers, the support, general support for at least the ideas of the New Deal, and the idea of, as one of the papers I remember said something to the effect, we need to corral the bulls of Wall Street, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, that appeared over and over again. As the New Deal programs were implemented, though, we began to see some of the same stories that we had seen prior to the New Deal. Mm-hmm. Many of the New Deal programs, farm programs and such, were funneled through local elites, local political elites. And there were some farmers' organizations that were beginning to complain about the uneven distribution of farm subsidies and the funds and so forth from the farm programs, and how they were benefiting, again, those who needed it least. Mm-hmm. So we began to see some of that. But overall, I looked at some oral history interviews as well, and the memory of the New Deal was quite positive from those oral histories that I looked at. And overall, I would say the New Deal and the idea of, again, of the state there and what it was trying to do seemed to be supported more than opposed by most rural people in the Ozarks.
So what sorts of transitions then do we see in the region from Depression through New Deal through the end of World War II and then into the post-war years? How does the economic development in the Ozarks proceed, and what are the attitudes towards government like at this point? Or do they change? Do they stay sort of the same with these tensions between local and federal? What's happening there?
I think there's still hope. Coming out of World War II, I start one chapter there with a letter that I found of a rural woman who has a very small farm community who's writing to the governor, and clearly she has these expectations that government has a responsibility to step in and help lift families in her community, help provide economic opportunities and so forth. We began to see, going back to the New Deal, these patterns again emerging where these federal resources and power are largely put into the hands of these local elites, who then use them for their own, you know, kind of agendas, industrial agribusiness type of agendas. And so what we see, one of the big legacies of kind of the New Deal, were the creation of these large hydroelectric dams and lakes in the region. And that was, I mean, these were obviously very, very expensive government projects here. I mean, they put a lot of people to work. And so for that, I mean, for that reason, these were desperate times. They began building the first one, North Fork Dam, in the early 40s. And so many rural people were obviously very happy to have extra work opportunities and so forth. But the idea behind these dams was that, you know, once we develop these dams, industry will start coming in. The idea is it'll lift all boats. Mm-hmm. It'll help farmers, there'll be non-farm work, industry will come in, agriculture will get more efficient, and all of that. That idea continues after World War II, through and after World War II. The idea that that's the solution to helping rural people is to bring in industry, to promote agribusiness, more efficient agribusiness models, as opposed to the traditional small family farm. And so that's the solution offered by both conservatives and liberals through the 1950s and 60s. And new programs were developed as we moved on into the Kennedy and Johnson years. There was some of the listeners may be aware of the Appalachian Regional Commission. There were actually a few other regional commissions. One of them was the Ozarks Regional Commission. So that got underway. It was operated differently than the Appalachian Regional Commission. But the idea there is to use federal resources to pump money into these rural economies to promote industrial business growth and so forth. But and they did. But and we start to see some parts of the region, growth centers or larger towns, get bigger. Their populations begin to swell, grow bigger, grow more affluent, and so forth. But it actually seems to hasten the deterioration of smaller rural communities. Is a small family farmer are numbered. They're pretty much over by the late 60s. Anyway, that type of solution did not achieve the promises that were made there and led to a lot of disappointment and in some cases resentment.
And so was there any sort of TVA style, Tennessee Valley Authority style, big planning? Was that also going on in the Ozarks? I mean, it sounds kind of like a similar thing. And then ultimately, as this plays out, you have your winners and your losers in the game, right? So is that that phenomena is also then happening, you know, in Arkansas and not just sort of further south? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So the going back into the New Deal there, the original bill submitted for that pilot project, that Norfolk Dam, was actually, it called for what it called the White River Authority.
Okay.
It was modeled on the TVA. Congressman Clyde Ellis proposed that. And so, yeah, that was the idea initially, although, well, there was a very large power company in Arkansas called Arkansas Power and Light that strongly opposed that and really had to be won over before that, the details of that legislation, but especially the hydroelectric part of that, could be passed. But in doing all of that, it was interesting that I found a letter that Clyde Ellis, the congressman, submitted that, had written to an attorney in St. Louis, I believe, but basically saying, well, the White River Authority idea is just basically a political tactic to get it through. If we can get it without a, you know, begin this kind of government planning organization, I'm all for it. And that's essentially what they got. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers undertook these projects, and so we didn't really see the kind of more managed system of TVA. But yeah, I mean, it's all born out of that same idea.
Moving forward a bit, you started to kind of touch on the Kennedy years, and then moving into the war on poverty in the 1960s. This you identify as an important turning point for residents of the Ozarks in the history of relationship with government and government resistance. Why do you see this as a moment of, as you call it, quote unquote, new Ozarks defiance? And why is that important given what came before?
Yeah. Well, so as I undertook this project, I mean, my radar was up as I was looking over this long period of time. I was looking for conflicts with government, right? So I'm looking for instances of resistance, and so I began to see in the war on poverty, naturally, some resistance there. But I began to notice that this is different. This is a different kind of resistance than I was looking at, you know, when I was talking about the moonshiners and the revenuers and all that, and the early opposition to some of the federal farm programs, that kind of thing. This is complaints against the war on poverty are coming from primarily regional political and business elites.
Okay.
It's not your working class people. Again, I think this is a reflection of the transformations that have occurred by that time. The rise of a light industry. Tourism was important, increasingly important part of the regional economy, and agribusiness. Again, all that depended on low wage, non-unionized labor. Mm-hmm. So there was this major outcry, especially when these regional political elites realized that poverty programs were not going to be funneled through their hands as most federal programs had in the past. And so they really began to kick up about that. It's interesting to see some of the early, you know, when the announcements were made about the war on poverty and so forth, some of the political elites in the region did a complete flop within a few weeks after they realize how these programs are going to work, they're suddenly against it, while they had been supportive of it before. But so this is a different kind of defiance, as I argue, and it's a different economy, largely. And so they are resisting the war on poverty now as they try to defend this, what I call new Ozarks economy, light industry, agribusiness, tourism, retail, kind of, but the key low wage, non-union kind of economy that they depend on. So it's a different kind of defiance. And as I argue, as I finish the book, this is more akin to the anti-government sentiments that seem to be so predominant in the region today. It's kind of the roots of that. Certainly more akin to that than the prior working class resistance that I discussed in earlier parts of the book.
So to round us out, as we sort of fast forward to today, to more modern times, how do you see your book, Hillbilly Hellraisers, contributing to the conversation, the ongoing national discussions, and to a better understanding about what have been referred to as quote unquote Trump voters, which are often discussed as, you know, economically disenfranchised white members of a disappearing middle or working class? How is this, you know, helping us better understand that?
Yeah. Well, Trump did very, very well in the Ozarks. Shortly after the election, I was corresponding with Brooks Blevins, a historian of the Ozarks, and he had been collecting some political data on the region's history. But I believe it was the most lopsided presidential election since Buchanan in 1856.
Wow.
So, so Trump was immensely popular in the Ozarks, so it seems. Of course, you get into, well, how much of that was Trump's popularity and how much of it was animosity toward Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I mean, of course, I was here during the election and doing some traveling in the region, throughout the region, leading up to November, and I was just amazed at the number of yard signs I would see, you know, Trump, Pence. But I as far as these national conversations go, there's been a lot of discussion of J.D. Vance's hillbilly elegy
recently
in the media and so forth, and it seems to be billed as the go-to book for understanding the Trump voter. I have my qualms with Vance's portrayal. I mean, it's largely a cultural explanation. It seems kind of blaming the culture, rural working class culture there. You know, he talks about culture of entitlement and I'm the victim kind of mentality. What I seem to observe is during the elections is that the loudest supporters of Trump tended to be the most comfortable, the most prosperous. They tended to be relatively well-to-do agribusiness owners or own some kind of a business or something like that. So they're undoubtedly a lot of working class. Wasn't undoubtedly a lot of working class support, but my point is, I think the last part of my book, Hillbilly Hellraisers, and the discussion of this transformation of economy and the roots of that new Ozarks politics of defiance, I think are important to understand there, because I see that as the support enthusiasm for Trump more as a continuation of that same kinds of opposition that we saw to the war on poverty in the 1960s, be led by this new Ozarks business elite, political elite, more so than working class. So I'm always kind of grimace when I hear the discussions of the white working class as Trump's mates. A lot of support there, but that's not, I don't see that as the main base. There's a lot. We'll obviously be trying to unravel this as historians for a long time, but I do think again, the last part of the book is important to think about as scholars and so forth, to think about how rural America has changed, how different, so very different it is and has become really in the last 50 years or so. Again, back to the old image of that rural America is this place of permanence. It's always the same. I think we need to understand that it's not.
Right.
It's constantly in flux. It's constantly changing. So.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about and some great historical context with which to do that. So, Blake Perkins, thank you for joining us on this episode of Working History.
Thank you, Beth. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks again to J. Blake Perkins, author of Hillbilly Hellraisers, Federal Power and Populist Defiance in the Ozarks, published by the University of Illinois Press. And thank you for listening to this episode of Working History, produced by the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org and follow Working History on Twitter at Working History.